Okay, I'm going to begin. We will assume one or two others will arrive as we go along. First, to introduce myself, I'm Tony Travers from the Government Department and the Institute of Public Affairs. And this is one of a number in a series. Sorry, I'm assuming the filming already, I should say, before I lose my moment of fame. You're all right, are you? I'll start again then, just to create some degree of rationality. Welcome to this, the latest in a series of Brexit lunchtime lectures, which are being put on, for the obvious reason, the series ran last term as well, in the aftermath of the EU referendum vote on the 23rd of June last year. It was decided by Kevin here and myself to run a series of these seminars this term. And as I said earlier on when I was first introducing myself, I'm Tony Travers from the Government Department and from the Institute of Public Affairs. What I want to do this week is to talk about the challenges of governance in the United Kingdom. So we've thought and heard a great deal about, and I'm talking about nationally and in the press debate and so on, about the way the UK will have to exit from the European Union and how this will be very complicated, trade deals, deals about migration and so on in the months and years ahead. And what I think inevitably received rather less interest is what this means for, not just for the government of Britain, I'll say a bit about that, but also about the electoral geography of Britain, because the referendum result told us things about the UK and about differences between voters in different parts of the UK and different voters with different backgrounds, which although we sort of knew, we now know and think about very, very much more than we did before. So I want to look at some of the voting patterns, as I say, the electoral geography of the Brexit vote. And then also, I want to consider the more day-to-day humdrum, though they're not that humdrum, actually, impacts on the way British government functions. So that's broadly how I'm going to do this. And then I'm going to end with just a few thoughts about the UK Constitution, about the British Constitution. So, political geography first, future of government in the UK second, and constitutional implications third. First, a bit of history, slightly odd version of the United Kingdom this, on this chart. This is the 1975 EEC, as it then was, European Economic Community referendum result, because, of course, the 2016 referendum was not the first that the Britons tried on this subject, but the second. The first one was for similar reasons, i.e., at the time, Harold Wilson, who was the Prime Minister at that time, the Labour government, his party was split, the left of the Labour Party didn't like the European Union, so it was a capitalist club. The centre-right of the centre and right of the Labour Party, much more pro-EU, and Wilson, or EEC, Wilson held a referendum in 1975, we'd only been in the EEC for 2 years at that point, to sort out an internal party political problem, to sort it out once and for all, he thought. And in fact, it did work like that. David Cameron, with a similar problem, in his case, with strongly pro-Brexit, often on the right members, against his more moderate centrist members of the Conservative Party, thought he'd use the same trick, the same tool, to sort that out, and of course this time it didn't work out. But what's interesting about this is that this is a chart which shows the vote in 1975, and broadly the lighter areas were less in favour of staying in the EEC. In fact, all parts of the country voted to stay in, I think. But the lighter the areas were less pro-Remain, and the darker were more pro-Remain. And what's interesting about that, of course, if you look at the result this time, it's the other way around. So that the Scots and Northern Ireland and even London were rather less in favour of staying in the EEC than other parts of the country, particularly some of those on the east and rural areas, which were strongly in favour of the EEC in 1975. But if you look at vote this time, and these are shown by local authority area, which is how the results were declared, you see this very different pattern, with Scotland and Northern Ireland voting to remain, and most authorities in Northern Ireland, all in Scotland, and most in London voting to remain, and many of the other parts of the country, particularly the East and the South, voting to leave. So, just as a starting point, a remarkable inversion between those who wanted to stay back in 1975 and those who wanted to stay today, and vice versa. Now, what do we know about this? These are local authority-based results. So you see there that most of rural England and Wales, some of the yellow points in Wales have universities in them, so you've got Aberystwyth and Bangor in Ceredigion and Gwynedd, respectively, and you've got other places around London and the southeast, and Bristol there, and the area around Bristol, and some of the other core cities. But overwhelmingly, by local authority, what you've got is a result showing a vote to leave, and in some cases by a large margin. But of course, this is not looking at it by parliamentary constituency. And the way in which UK politics inevitably works, and we've seen this in the last few days in the House of Commons, is MPs sitting in the House of Commons looking at how their constituents voted, how they themselves feel, and then trying to work out how to vote accordingly on the basis of that. So this is some analysis done by Chris Hanretti of the University of East Anglia, which has somehow fallen off this chart. And what he did was to take these local authority results and then reconstruct them as if they were by constituency. Some local authorities perfectly match constituencies, most don't. So this is a bit of assumption. There's quite a lot of assumptions underlying this. But looking at it by parliamentary constituency, he works out that 421 out of 574 England and Wales constituencies probably voted to leave, of which 270 definitely voted to leave, 152 probably to remain. Of these, about 76 definitely voted to remain. Now, why does this matter? It's because constituency members of Parliament, thinking about, let us say, the Article 50 vote, have to bear in mind that whatever their personal views, their constituencies have a view. And by the way, opinion polling undertaken since the referendum does not show what many Remainers hoped, which is the big remorse, and people think, oh, we should have voted the other way. It doesn't show that at all. It shows that since 23rd of June, by and large, the Leave and Remain votes have stayed very similar over that time. So this, I'm going to come back to this issue because it has affected, and you've seen it in a very agonising way for MPs, how they've had to vote in the Article 50 bill. And I think it will go on affecting British politics like this for some time to come. So here we've got the stated voting intentions of MPs. This was undertaken just before, this was research undertaken just before the vote, in fact. But what it shows is that if you compare it with how local authorities voted, which isn't quite the same thing, this is showing that overwhelmingly, particularly if you aim off for the fact that many of those who were in favour, many of the MPs in favour of leaving represent large geographical constituencies. So this chart exaggerates despite its slight sort of not quite Mercator's projection version of the UK again, slightly stretched version of the UK. So the blue areas which are showing Leave MPs are actually, you know, geographically bigger than many of the constituencies represented by the yellow Remain ones. So a substantial majority of MPs, and this is replicated in the House of Lords, and again, this matters when it comes to voting on these issues, most parliamentarians are in favour of Remain in a country that has voted by 51.8 to 48.2 to leave. And that is a real difficulty for parliamentarians as lawmakers as the process moves ahead. This is looking at the same statistics, but this time by region. Now, region and nation, I should say. So what we have is Northern Ireland voting and I'll come back to Northern Ireland, voting to remain. Now, Northern Ireland, seen traditionally as a rather small C conservative part of the UK, lots of unionist politics, many unionists not that enthusiastic about the EU, much more enthusiastic about the union with the UK, of course. But because of the large border with an open border with the Republic of Ireland and enormous amounts of trade flowing backwards and forwards across that border, Northern Ireland votes to remain. Scotland, now remember there was a referendum in Scotland in 2014 about independence, which in fact was lost by those pro-independence by 55-45, but the way in which Scottish nationalism and the SNP suffuses other votes and other attitudes in Scotland clearly affects voting beyond nationalism. Look what happened to the Labour Party in the 2015 general election to see how that can turn out. And clearly, every single local authority in Scotland, by votes declared by every authority, voted to remain in the European Union. Then in London, every region taken as a whole voted against, most strongly in the East and West Midlands, where there was a very substantial vote against the EU in the East Midlands and the West Midlands, so the industrial heartlands there across those two middle regions. But London, dear old London, where we are here, voted by 60-40 to remain. So London is the only region in England and Wales that voted remain, further complicating, for reasons I'll come back to, the political geography of this result. So we've now got MPs and peers often not on the same side as voters, whole areas of the country, particularly one that held a referendum thinking it might leave the UK, on the opposite side to the majority of those in England. And then you've got an England-Scotland thing, or a Northern Ireland and Scotland-England thing in here. So is this an English nationalism vote? I took part in an event in here immediately after the referendum, where the point was made, you can see the pro-Leave vote as a sort of heroic English nationalist cry, the nearest there is to an English nationalism vote that we've ever seen to match Scottish nationalism and Welsh nationalism. Now, we can argue about that, but here's another way of looking at the electoral and political geography of this result. And within London, now you might think, well, London, international city, 40% of people working in London today were not born in the United Kingdom, one of the most international cities in the world. Surely it voted extensively to remain in the EU. Actually, five boroughs didn't vote to stay in the EU. So where the figure is below 30, so on the eastern fringe here, Havering, Barking in Dagenham, Bexley, three boroughs here, Hillingdon, where Heathrow Airport is, over there, 44, and Sutton, which is controlled by the Liberal Democrats. Think about that as an oddity. Liberal Democrats, the only party really unsplit by this issue in favour of being in the European Union. The only borough in London that they control voted to leave the European Union. Now, there are social and demographic reasons for that. There's a huge council estate there which used to vote Labour. Labour died out, replaced by the Liberal Democrats. But in the east here, as well as would be true in the north of England, these are areas with significant white working-class populations, a lot of deindustrialisation. The same kind of factors as we've seen in other parts of the country are seen to explain, at least in part, why people voted to leave the EU. So even, and of course, at the other end of the spectrum, apart from Gibraltar, and I think Gibraltar is the top, you've got some very high votes here to stay in the EU, 79% in Lambeth, 76% in Haringey there, 75% in Camden, where the new academic building is, a bit lower here in Westminster, 69%. But even in Westminster, 69%. So you've got an inner-outer thing going on here as well. And this has caused, as we'll see in a moment, inner London MPs, particularly Labour MPs, to rebel substantially against their party when it comes to triggering Article 50, taking the view that these voters, put it bluntly, are not going to take kindly, particularly where these percentages are high, if their MP then votes to leave the EU. But I'll come back to that. It's not as simple as that, in fairness to the MPs concerned. How do we compare the EU referendum vote with how people voted in the general election of 2015. I would say 2015, only under 2 years ago, seems like a generation ago now. Well, what you find is that all the parties, including UKIP, are split, if you look at how people voted. So at the top there, you've got the Conservative Party, split 42-58. Labour, 63-37, so much more strongly Remain, obviously. The Liberal Democrats, now the Liberal Democrats, strongly pro-EU party, but even they're split 70-30, so 30% of people who voted Lib Dem in 2015 voted to leave the EU. I'll leave out UKIP for a moment, because I always treasure that. The Greens, 75-25, there are Greens who are not over-enthusiastic about corporatist, pro-market EU, perhaps. And then the SNP. Now, the SNP, again, set themselves up very strongly. We've got a strong, strong argument for the SNP about Scotland not being damaged by Britain voting to leave the EU and how it's anti-Scottish. And yet, look, 36% of SNP voters voted. Now, they, of course, would probably inherit it from the Labour Party. They'd have been ex-Labour voters in industrial Scotland who voted SNP because they were fed up with Labour, for all sorts of reasons we could discuss at another time, but actually not over-enthusiastic about the European Union. Then we'll come back to UKIP. I've always been intrigued by the 4%. Every poll that you ever see about how UKIP voters split, 96% voted to leave the EU. That I understand. I mean, I see how they, I can see, given UKIP's position and why it exists. But the 4% who voted Remain seem to me among the most interesting people in British politics. Anybody knows any? I think we should definitely have them to the school to give a seminar or join a panel or something. So, but the point, the serious point I want to make here is that all the British parties are split on the issue, heroically split. If you are one of the even the three or four or five major parties we've got in Britain now today, all of them, six, including UKIP, all split. Same would have been true of the Welsh nationalists if we'd had figures for them here as well. And then there are demographic differences. Now, again, this has been rehearsed much more extensively right across the media ever since Election Day. These are figures from Lord Ashfield polls. I'm sorry, this source has been trimmed as well. So men were slightly more in favour of leave than women. No, they weren't. It's exactly the same, actually. Sorry, I'll just read it. Slightly, very similar. So the same percentage of men and women. But the young, 73%, 18 to 24-year-olds split, 73 to 27. And if you then go to 65 plus, 60-40 or 40-60 the other way. So there's a generational issue tied up in this. Broadly, the older you are, the more likely you are to have voted to leave. As a general rule, these figures suggest. And then at the bottom, you've got social classifications, A, B, C1, C2, DE, showing, again, and this has been much discussed, that broadly in the higher social and economic classifications, you're more likely to have voted to remain. And in the lower ones, you're more likely to have voted for leave. There's lots of ways you can cut these numbers. This is just very simple. And again, I simply want to get across the idea that Britain is a nation divided. It's divided in fragmented ways, geographically, by age, not by gender, by social class, and in other ways besides, by nation and region. And that, I think, is an issue that will affect British politics for many, many years to come. And not only in the matter of Europe, though I do think, personally, that whether you're in favour or leaving the EU has elements of a culture war about it, in the sense that it's an issue that divides people across party lines and in a way that affects their views even amongst friends. It cuts across. It's in the way that some issues in the United States for a number of years have been seen as culture clash issues. This one overrides party. I was watching, if any of you watched an interview, which you can get on the Guardian website, of Owen Jones interviewing Anna Soubry. Anna Soubry is a Conservative MP who's definitely been one of those most vociferous since the vote. Well, of course, there you've got lots of people on the left thinking, Anna Soubry, you know, wonderful, wonderful. And you begin to see, you know, Ken Clark, wonderful, wonderful. People on the left suddenly liking these Conservative MPs. And then on the, it works the other way around too. There will be people on the Brexit side who look at those Labour MPs like Gisela Stewart, Kate Hoey, who voted for Brexit strongly. You know, that creates links there too. And so this is, I think, if you look at the longer term evolution of British politics, where the tribal nature of the Conservative and Labour vote has been in decline since the mid-1950s, this issue cuts right across still further the traditional left-right divide. Now, it's not unique to this issue, it's not unique to this country, but it's a very interesting way of thinking about it. And the reason I'm going on about this, and I'll stop in a moment, is that it then affects the way in which the government and the opposition parties behave in Parliament as all of this goes through to fruition and the UK finally leaves the European Union, which I am convinced it will. So here is the Article 50 bill in full. I thought you might like to read it. It's one of these things, you know, academics are fond of using slides that can't be read. This is a rare example of an entire bill that can be read from the back row, I hope. And it just says the Prime Minister may notify under Article 50, brackets, two brackets, of Treaty on European Union, the United Kingdom's intention to withdraw from the EU. And this section has effect despite any provision made by or under the European Communities Act 1972 or any other enactment. Very Henry VIII, that, isn't it? Short title. Might be, though that's it. There it is. And this is what it's all about. And I'm going to say a little bit more about this and about the court case that brought this bill and the vote around it into existence. But it begs a really interesting question for me, which goes back to Burke and study of British constitution, of whether members of Parliament are representatives or delegates. I mean, in popular discourse, it might be easy to see an MP as a delegate, sent by their constituents to Parliament to do what the voters of Stoke-on-Trent, not quite chosen at random, want. But the truth is, MPs are normally seen as representatives. They're not delegates, they're representatives who come to Parliament, and MPs make their own decisions then on the basis of all the facts in front of them, but making them as an individual, and then they're judged at the next general election. But this issue has clearly brought that long-term matter for public study into a much more visible profile. So I've just chosen four MPs here. We've got Catherine West, who is a Labour MP in West Streeting, another Labour MP, relatively recent additions to the House of Commons, I think 2010 or 2015 for each of them. Now, Catherine West said on her Twitter feed, 75% of my constituents voted to remain in the EU. I stand with them on this issue and will vote against Brexit in Parliament. So that is effectively saying I'm going to be guided by the percentages we saw in that London Borough chart. This is slightly nearer the delegate end of the spectrum than the representative. Whereas Streeting, on the other hand, who is also in favour of Remain, both in favour of Remain, he said why I voted in favour of the EU withdrawal bill last night on a point of principle. So he's saying I'm going to be guided by the wider vote of the British people, even though personally I and my constituents voted to remain. So I'm not saying either of these is better or worse, they're just exemplifications of the stresses and strains, particularly on London Labour MPs, that we've seen. Then if we look at Karen Buck, a Labour MP, voted against the party whip, so as indeed must have Catherine West, but voted against the party whip. And Kenneth Clark, the famous, now nearly in Parliament for 50 years, Conservative MP, he's been in every government since more or less Mr. Heath was Prime Minister, you know, helped take Britain into, or took Britain into the EU, an ardent Europhile, not a London MP, but both of them voted against the party whip, Karen Buck and he both voting against the bill. So an enormous amount of pressure and stress and strain on these individual MPs. Notwithstanding that, it went through easily by 498 votes to 114. So in the 114 will have been Catherine West, Karen Buck and Ken Clark, amongst lots of other Labour, Liberal Democrat, SNP MPs. Although I'm going to come back to this issue, what this tells me is that the decision by a member of the public to require Parliament to take a vote on this, which, by the way, the government resisted, turns out to have empowered the government, not to weaken them, which I suspect is the opposite of what those who originally thought the legislation of this, kind would do. We'll come back to that, and I think if you listen to the media today about all of this, it's clear that not only the existence of the legislation, but the problems it's caused for the highly fragmented opposition, that the whole process has worked to strengthen the government in getting a free hand in dealing with the EU referendum negotiations. And who would have thought of that when the process of the High Court case started, when Parliament, when the government, I should say, was trying to resist having a bill to do with all of this, and those who are in favour of the bill thought it would give them greater toehold, greater control over the government. Therefore, and this is a very good example of, I think, be careful what you wish for. So, what can we conclude from this? Well, as I said a moment ago, the Leave and Remain votes both cut across party lines, much less for the Conservatives than for Labour, but certainly across both, and for MPs in both parties, therefore creating a long-term challenge as to how they vote. Labour, in particular, face a challenge because many of their traditional voters voted Leave. Labour's in the middle, nothing to do with Brexit, of a freestanding existential crisis as well. And, of course, if you look at the London vote, large numbers of relatively well-off, graduate-type Labour voters in London voted strongly for Labour in the mayoral election and then in the general election last time, and have voted to remain in this vote. But Labour's traditional vote, I mentioned Stoke-on-Trent earlier on, there's a by-election coming up on the 23rd of February in Stoke-on-Trent, where the Labour Party has to appeal there to Labour voters who overwhelmingly will have voted to leave. So the Labour Party, you can see why it's now split totally, and Keir Starmer, one of the LSE's local MPs, who happens to be the opposition spokesperson on these issues, has not hidden the fact that this is a nightmare problem for Labour, which represents, I think I'm right in saying, both the five most pro-Remain constituencies in the country and the five most pro-Leave constituencies in the country. Labour holds all of those. And that is a real challenge for a party in the middle of an existential crisis that, frankly, has nothing to do with this, but which this feeds into. As I said a moment ago, I think the parliamentary vote actually strengthened the government's position, when I suspect those who wanted the vote thought it might do the opposite. And if you certainly listen to Norman Smith, the BBC's political correspondent on the Today programme this morning, talking about the offer that the government made yesterday to hold a vote on the deal that is struck, the draft deal that is struck, you know, he, I think he was quoting from The Godfather, I won't go too far with this one, especially as it's all being recorded, but that boils down to the choice MPs will be left with, and is either go with the deal the government struck, or just leaving, crashing out of the EU on the highest tariffs and the most difficult conditions you can think of. Not quite, an offer you can't refuse, that's what I think he said. So there we are. The Article 50 vote, I think, exposed the difference between MPs' votes and those of the majority of the UK voters. That didn't come as a big surprise. We know that. It's going to go into the House of Lords, where this will be even more on display, because Labour and the Liberal Democrats and the crossbenchers have a majority in the House of Lords. The Lords is almost certainly in favour of Remain as well. But, of course, it is not an elected House, so it's some stage away from the referendum vote, two stages away, you might argue. And, you know, at any point, the threat of reform would hang over it if they went too far in opposing Article 50, the Article 50 bill. So MPs face a difficult choice as they vote for the Article 50 bill, possibly a bit less difficult from now on. Is there any further votes, certainly, for example, in the committee stage of the bill, and as we go on later on, it will become less difficult for them to vote as they precisely feel, but we'll see about that. And, of course, running off the bottom here, it just says London is very different from the rest of England. I made that point with the map, but it's, if you look at the way London Labour MPs broke the party whip as a group, many of them as a group, not all, many of them, just tells you about how disconnected London's politics has become from those of the rest of the United Kingdom. And that in turn tells us something about the Labour Party in particular, but not only about the Labour Party. Now, what are the challenges? That's the political geography of all of this, and that, I think, is the backdrop for all that I'm about to discuss. Now, I want to look at the challenges for government. Exiting the European Union, the challenges for Parliament, the issues raised, the government, the judiciary, the civil service, managing and reforming the economy, and subnational impacts. I'll just take these one by one. First thing to bear in mind is everything that's going on now is against 44 years of the United Kingdom, I think I've got the maths right here, haven't I? Yes, 44 years, of the UK within the European Union. So every act of Parliament, every decision made by regulators and so on, and the whole of the regulatory regimes within the United Kingdom that have evolved over this period, have done so, absorbing EU law where necessary, EU regulations and so on. All of our laws conform to, within the relevant periods of areas of competence, all absorbed into UK law. And this, of course, lay at the bottom of many people who were in favour of leaving the EU just didn't like that. And that's one of the reasons that many parliamentarians who voted to leave wanted to get out. But for the time being, it's an issue that they now have to cope with. All the economic decision-making within the United Kingdom, tax-making, public spending and so on, and all the economic planning, such as there is in Britain, has gone on within EU rules as well. So the economy, it's a European Union economy with all of the trade deals and tariffs and all the other things that have affected the decisions of chancellors over the last 44 years. This is all against the background of decades of what I thought long and hard about the use of the word particular, media and political depiction of Europe. And I put the word Europe in inverted commas because it's often described as Europe, when in fact, of course, Europe is more than the European Union. It's a thousand years of culture and history of which Britain is a part. But the media political depiction has rarely been positive, and that, I think, was one of the big, big problems that the Remainers had in their campaigning, that they had to put across the unusual positive picture about the EU. Everybody had already imbibed the full, even Remain people, were often quite negative about the EU, even though they wanted to remain. So the need for a positive take on the European Union, its institutions, and Europe as a cultural concept was completely missing in the end from that debate. And of course, the other thing about our relationship with the EU is there are some real problems. The common agricultural policy, even people who are really pro-EU never really thought the common agricultural policy was a bright way of running agricultural subsidies and so on. And migration policy, the difficulties that Europe, broadly defined, but mostly the EU, has had in managing the consequences of international movements of people in the last 2, 3, 4, 5 years, not its fault, but nevertheless, it's exposed challenges and difficulties which have fed back into the British media, even those who are positive about Europe. It hasn't fed brilliantly back into it. So there's some real problems that the EU and Britain's relationship with the EU still, you know, had never quite sorted out and now contributed to the Leave vote. The other thing that intrigues me, and it's been my area of specialism, is, of course, the European Union, although a supranational body, has over time evolved regional policy, urban policy and local policy. It always struck me that this was probably in part to sort of reach over the heads of national politics to regions and to cities who were much more friendly and liked to go to the Committee of the Regions, be treated nicely in Brussels, gets, you know, argue for resources for the regions and Committee of Regions and so on. But that too has it creates a problem, not least of which is that there are many regions of the United Kingdom and areas within regions that are enormously dependent on EU agricultural or structural fund resources, which are all going to either come to a halt or have to be replicated by UK government action from here on. So which institutions are broadly affected by? Oh, I'm going to look at anyway, many are affected. Parliament and the political parties, the government, different departments within government. I'll come back to all of these points, it's just a starting point. The civil service, particularly having a problem, I think, of being seen to be impartial, which is the British civil service's long and genuine advantage, one of many. You know, it has been, it is impartial, but in the middle of what I've described as a culture war, it's quite hard for civil servants to sustain that impartiality. Or at least others can say they're not impartial and attack them. And this has happened already, that they're accused of all being Remainers in some way and therefore somehow not able to work effectively with the government on delivering a good outcome from exiting the European Union. I'm not saying that's true, but it's certainly been alleged. There's the judiciary, I'll say a bit more about them in a moment. The devolved governments, subnational and local government, do they have a role within the UK constitution? Well, we've found out the answer to that question is no, but I'll come back to that in a moment. And then beyond that, there is the public who have triggered all of this. Well, Parliament started it, the public took advantage of it with the referendum. And a lot of work's been done by academics and others about why the public voted to leave the EU. What was it, other than leaving the EU, that people voted for? Now, we have some clues about that. But the truth is, there are going to be many reasons. Let us say some parts of the country felt economically left behind. Some people thought there was too much immigration or too much immigration from Europe or something. Now, whatever those expectations are, Parliament, the government more generally, will have to work that out and try and ensure that the consequences of leaving the EU, at least in part, address some of those problems. Those perceived problems. Very much, and this is, and I'm not going to refer too much to Donald Trump today, but if you look at Donald Trump's vote, it too embraced many of the same kind of reasons, I think we can infer, people who are left behind in parts of the country, rural areas against cities, forgot to mention that earlier on. And with all of that in mind, how you deliver when you're in government to convince the people who voted for you or for the cause that they're getting something out of it, I think is going to be a big challenge for politicians in this country and, of course, for Donald Trump as we move forward. But I'm not going to talk much more about him today. What about Parliament? Well, in some ways, and certainly for parliamentarians who were strongly in favour of leaving the EU, UK parliamentary sovereignty, you know, inherited from the Crown over centuries, was the prime reason, getting back control of our laws, getting back control of our immigration policy. All of this was, so the sovereignty of Parliament is seen as highly important, certainly by Parliament itself. And of course, following the Leave vote on the 23rd of June, up popped the question of whether Parliament should have any role in the process of withdrawal. Now, you don't have to read Alice in Wonderland to think that there is something a bit curious about this, that having voted to take back power to the UK Parliament, then having the government, the Crown in effect, saying, well, it's only for us, the Crown, using Crown prerogative to make the decision. Parliament has no role in it, which is broadly what was debated in the High Court and then the Supreme Court, does seem a bit odd. And I'll come back at the end of this, because actually in the end parliamentary sovereignty has asserted itself, but not in a way that empowers the government, as it turns out. So, notwithstanding the fact the government lost, both in the High Court and the Supreme Court, had to introduce the Article 50 bill, there is still the issue of how far to involve Parliament triggering the exit process. Well, that bill's currently before Parliament. The detail of the negotiating framework. Now, when it comes to negotiations, the one thing we can be sure is everything will leak. And all the negotiations will be going on behind closed doors, but oddly, we'll find out what's going on. MPs representing particular industries, could be universities, could be the aerospace industry, areas of the country will all want their say if things don't seem to be going their way, or if the particular trade deals and tariff rules or migration rules are not working out in the way that they want. So there's bound to be a parliamentary interest in the negotiating framework. Also, in the objectives of the government. What is the long-term objective of the government? Broadly, Britain being a free trade country, is that what it's all about? Or an independent free trading nation? Whatever it is, they want to have a role in the objectives and setting the objectives. Trade policy, not only with the EU, with other countries, and of course, in ongoing deal making. That is, although the government has tried to keep for itself almost all the deal making and all the negotiating about deal making, the idea that MPs are just going to stand back for what might be 10 years and not demand some sort of role in this as it goes along, I think is implausible. Yeah, I don't know what the role will be, by the way, because it's taken, you know, two court cases to get the Article 50 bill into Parliament. But MPs are just not going to stand by for years, I suspect, without having quite a more detailed role than we've seen so far in this process. This is the government's white paper, published alongside the bill. You can get this online very easily. It gives a sort of broad picture of what the government's hoping to achieve. It's an interesting title. You know, the United Kingdom's exit from a new partnership with, very friendly sounding title, the European Union. But that's all we've got so far, really, that and the bill I showed you earlier. So this is a bit longer, in fairness, to this document, but that's it. Now, what are the issues for Parliament and government, and indeed for all of the players within the British political system? Well, the first and most obvious one after this bill is the Great Repeal Act. That is an Act of Parliament which will be introduced in the next Queen's Speech, which will convert all existing EU law, insofar as it affects the UK, into domestic law, wherever practical, I think the document I've just shown you says. So the Great Repeal Act will convert existing EU law into domestic law wherever practical. I mean, wherever practical is something of a concession, it must be said, or something of a limitation, but that's what that's going to do. There is the future of UK trade policy. Currently, trade policy is handled by the European Union on behalf of the United Kingdom, but we're going to have our own trade negotiators within the government's broad rubric of wanting to be a free trade nation. Even more important, certainly within the UK, will be the future of UK immigration policy. Now, this will be a question of how people who are EU citizens in future can get in and out of Britain, and Britons can get in and out of the EU 27. Will there have to be visas, more work permits? Another way of doing it, a points-based system for determining who can move around. None of this is determined, indeed none of it is spelled out even as a set of options so far. It's also important, I think, to hold in your mind the fact that although a lot of the debate about the EU, Britain exiting the EU, has been about immigration, the truth is that there is a separate discussion about controlling immigration in Britain, where the government is committed to reducing international net immigration to the tens of thousands. That's nothing to do with the EU, that's just a broad commitment of which leaving the EU could be thought to be a contributor. But of course, at the moment, non-EU net migration is running at 180,000 or 190,000 a year. So that's way ahead of the target for all migration. So quite how this works itself out, how the government and how Parliament negotiates all of this, very much open for debate. And in all of this, there will be different roles for Parliament, the UK government, and I'll come back to this in a moment, the devolved governments. And then, when all of these things have been determined by the broad political system, how or if should we then consult the electorate? There are people out there who still think there'll be another referendum. Personally, I think we're not going to see a national referendum in the UK for some time to come. So I think that is very, very unlikely. I know the Lib Dems are proposing this, and perfectly legitimate to do so. I just don't think it's going to happen. Will the next general election be fought on the terms that either are appearing to emerge or have emerged? remembering that if Theresa May triggers Article 50 in March next month, then the process, the Article 50 process, unless our European colleagues agree to extend it, will be over in 2 years. It's broadly considered that it will be, but the negotiations on the future of Britain's trading relationships won't be over in 2 years. So the next general election, in part, will be fought on the way the government has handled everything that's happened since 23rd of June last year. Now, at the moment, Theresa May is way out ahead in the opinion polls. Conservative 42, Labour 26, 27, 28. And in the, you know, our first pass of the post-voting system, that points to a Conservative majority of hundreds at the next general election unless anything changes. However, that system can't, in the end, it won't be like this for all time. Something will give, something will change. And then, so if, let us say, the Labour Party somehow got its act together, quite a big qualification, assuming the Labour Party got its act together quickly, or the Liberal Democrats emerged as a sort of new second party, you know, great breakthrough, or something like that, or UKIP did or something, then the next election could be much closer. And if it was much closer, that the pressure on the government party which was negotiating the EU referendum details would be vastly greater than it is today. Now, we don't know about that yet, but it could all happen. And, of course, the other way of consulting the electorate would be by a straightforward vote in Parliament. And, in fact, these are not, I mean, all three could happen, in fact. They're not mutually exclusive. And we will see votes in Parliament, even if it's only on the draft terms as I described them earlier on. But it's possible for Parliament to create other votes, particularly if public opinion were seen to change. At the moment, public opinion is still broadly in its 52-48 position, but if there were radical evidence that it had changed, and certainly if it changed some of the media coverage, if the economy seemed to be suffering, for example, then you can see that a vote in Parliament could end up very differently. For the time being, not, but it could change. What about the judiciary? Well, Gina Miller's court case in relation to triggering Article 50 was a fascinating struggle within the British government and political system. It brought the judiciary into the struggle between the Crown, represented by the Prime Minister and government, and Parliament. Should Parliament have a role? Actually, you know, this can be seen, and other distinguished, distinguished historians have made this point. It's like a rerun of the English Civil War. That was between the Crown, represented by Charles I, and Parliament and Oliver Cromwell. And here we've got the same thing, though mercifully on this occasion, fought out not on battlefields in England, but in the courts. A lot was said, and going back to my point about a culture war, was said at the time about the media reaction to the High Court's original ruling that Parliament should have a vote. Remember this? Now, that media reaction, I was less surprised about this than many people were. I think we know how the British media works across the board. It's not that surprising. Freedom of the press is an essential element of a democracy. Now, you may say attacking the judges head-on is a bit rough, and many politicians, including some pro-Brexit ones, made that point. But, as I said at the beginning, it now appears that the vote that Gina Miller wanted, the government didn't want, the Daily Mail didn't want, actually may have strengthened the government's position. And that the Daily Mail has actually got what it wanted, notwithstanding the judges who actually may have helped it get what it wanted. Complicated stuff. What about the government delivering all of this? Well, there's an enormous amount of pressure on government. The UK government, a sophisticated machine, Whitehall departments, senior civil servants, many of whom come to the LSE to talk about issues on a regular basis, but they've now got to deliver all of this. And it's going to be a long and complicated and bitterly fought process. First, somebody has to decide what Brexit means. The Prime Minister has elegantly said for some time that Brexit means Brexit. But the difficulty that she faces, and we all face in fairness to her, is that there was no Brexit party fighting the referendum. On the one side stood effectively the Remain party, which was most of the political establishment, and they were effectively arguing for the same world that existed on the day before the referendum, easily understood. Britain as it is, was, is. But on the Leave side, which was itself a coalition of quite different Leave campaigners, there was no manifesto. It's not like a general election. So there is no Brexit offer, nothing to negotiate precisely, no pattern, no programme to deliver. So what we're now going to see is the government, or seeing before our very eyes, is a remarkable reconstruction of the British central state to create a bureaucratic machine to deliver this negotiated but as yet undefined or ill-defined Brexit. And you need a machine to do this. British civil servants, highly trained, very effective, impartial, all the things we know about them. But they've now got to turn themselves to exit from, not only to pull us out of the EU, which is the first stage, but only when that's done, to negotiate new trade and migration deals with individual countries and blocs. So it's a two-stage process, and it certainly won't be over in 2 years. And of course, of particular interest to me is there'll be a need to link external treaties and deals, so all these new deals done with other countries, with the UK economy. Because each trade deal, each migration deal, will have a different effect inside the UK if it's negotiated one way as compared with another way. So, reforms to the Whitehall machine. Well, we've now got a department for exiting the European Union, headed by David Davis, a department for international trade. It's not exactly clear what that does yet, but at some point it will presumably negotiate international trade deals. And is working on looking up how that will work. The Foreign Office, which has been partially reformed by losing some of itself, much to its chagrin, I suspect. The Department of Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy, that's the internal department that has to produce the industrial strategy that will try to tie all this together internally. The Department for International Development, not a new department, but one whose focus, the international aid budget, has been radically turned around from being aid as we used to know it, much studied in the school, to a more pro-business, pro-trade version of an aid policy. That's going to be interesting to watch. 0.7% of GDP, still the government's avowed target, but a different function for the aid budget than one we've seen in the past, much more tied to trade. And then environment, food and rural affairs. Agriculture is not a large part of the UK economy, it's 1%. But in people's minds, it's vastly bigger. It's everywhere. And people have very strong and emotional views about agriculture and farming, and the rural lobby is very powerful. And so replacing the CAP with, you know, all these trade deals, as well as a new internal in agricultural policy for the UK, is going to be a massive job for that relatively small department. This is just a list of the ministers concerned. All these slides I'll make available if anybody wants them. Now, I made the point about the way the trade deals work differently from place to place. Now, I've just chosen the northeast of England here, first one I could find when I was producing the slides. And it's a study of the relative specialisation of the economy of the northeast of England compared with the UK average. So the blue lines on this side show that in the northeast region, electricity, gas, steam, and air conditioning supply, the energy industry, is big, relatively. Mining and quarrying, real estate, perhaps more surprisingly, public admin, manufacturing, above the UK average. And on this side, the grey lines going that way, financial and insurance services, agriculture, forestry, and fisheries. So what this tells us is that when a trade deal is being undertaken by a minister sitting across the table from the, let's say, the New Zealand, his or her New Zealand counterpart, then it matters slightly, if it's about agriculture, it matters less to this region than it will do to, I'm guessing, Wales or Scotland, where that bar will hang this way in Wales and Scotland. So it may look like an international trade deal, but it's actually a national trade deal. And Kevin Featherston and I were at an event earlier this morning where one of the people who was attended made the point which I'd not thought about, which is that in his view, and he was a senior ex-official in the UK government, in his view, what the government should have done was to publish an industrial strategy for the UK first and then use that as the basis for the trade deals with other countries. Whereas what we're going to do is it the other way round. We've already published the industrial strategy, and it isn't like that. Very interesting thought. And here's the sectors, here are the key issues for a particular sector. I'm not going to go through all of these, but for agriculture, there's an enormous list of issues that have to be tackled when we back out of the EU and set up our new relationship with the EU27 and with other countries. A really, really long list, which matters very much to some rural communities, not at all for most people in London, other than in their love for rural areas. Then what about the nations and regions of the United Kingdom? Scotland, Northern Ireland, London, which is not actually it's a region rather than a nation, all voted to remain. And in fact, their vote to remain was wider in favour of remain than the national vote to leave. That begs the question for me, if the sanctity of the mandate 52 to 48 means something, does it mean anything at a subnational level, particularly in a quasi-federal country? Is the UK a unitary state or a quasi-federal state? Well, of course, it's kind of both and neither. Now, in Scotland, the SNP-led government is threatening a second independence referendum in certain circumstances, and the certain circumstances boil down to the EU, Britain not being in the single market and or the currency, customs union. I think that's a simplification of the position, or not close enough to replicate it. Now, the question of whether the SNP-led government in Scotland could have a referendum without the UK government agreeing to it is also begged by all of this, but come back to that. In Northern Ireland, is there a threat to the Good Friday Agreement, which certainly benefited from the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland and the United Kingdom all being in the European Union? Clearly, there is a challenge and a problem there. But also, there is the issue of the Northern Ireland-Ireland border, which has been part of a common travel area, along with Jersey, Guernsey, the Isle of Man, other parts of the British Isles, for much longer than the whole existence of the European Union. Forget just Britain being a member of it. And there are roads in Northern Ireland and Ireland that just cross the border again and again while you're on the same road. Closing that border? Difficult. Having customs points, or not having customs points, means effectively you've got an open border between the EU and outside the EU. And how would that be organised? And this is a very big issue. Now, I should have said, so let me come on to a bit more about that. The implication of the UK government's stance in relation to exiting the European Union, it seems to me, is that the UK is still a unitary state, where only the UK Parliament and government can vote and negotiate on international issues such as EU membership. So we're not really a federal country. And the more Theresa May and the government says, the Scots, the Welsh, Northern Ireland effectively have to live within the rules that are negotiated by the UK government, the more we know the limits of the quasi-federal settlement within the United Kingdom. Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland will be consulted, but they have no veto, and that's the crucial thing. They've been explicitly told, including by a court case, that they have no power of veto. And so the union of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland now depends, I think, on responses to the deal struck by the UK government in the coming year. So all the things I've been talking about, which the UK government's now got to handle, will, when they're complete, determine whether there's another Scottish referendum, whether Northern Ireland can or stay, and Northern Ireland probably will remain in the UK, but on what terms? And, will it remain nearer being in the EU than any other part of the UK and so on? All of that will be determined by what is to come. So, that's my brief canter through the political geographical issues, the issues for the UK government, and some of the constitutional implications. One thing I would just apologise for is that I haven't given you a detailed exposition of how the UK, or what the UK government's position will be and how it will manage it. And the reason for that is we don't know. I wish I could tell you. I wish they could tell me. I wish they could tell all of us. But the truth is, in fairness to the government, These things are difficult. Theresa May and her government effectively took office almost by accident. I mean, certainly she did. You know, she was the person left standing after the extraordinary Conservative leadership campaign last year. She's now the Prime Minister of a government which has been given probably the single most difficult task facing any UK government since the outbreak of the Second World War, even more than the banking finance crisis of 2008, and that was up there with big challenges, and certainly more than joining the EU, which is a much gentler by assent process, a sort of love, care and affection process, whereas this is more akin to a divorce process and therefore more difficult. Anyway, I'll stop there. There are a few minutes for questions, and I have a note in front of me, or disagreements, or agreement, saying if you speak, could you use a microphone and stand up to do so? One, two, three. So let's go one, two, three is the order I saw them on. So.
Nicholas Barr, European Institute. Thanks a lot, Tony. That was absolutely terrific. If two students live together and then separate, they divide the rent deposit, they divide up the CDs, they go their separate ways. If a couple divorces after 44 years, it's horribly messy. The family home, who looks after the kids, etc. This is a divorce, so as you say, it's horribly messy. Mm. But it's worse than that, isn't it? Because it's not that the task is difficult, it's impossible, because the Leave people wanted things that it's impossible to do simultaneously. You know, single market on the one hand, but controlling immigration on the other. So in a way, it's not just a difficult task, it's an impossible one, because it's got its internal contradictions. And I guess my question is, how the heck do we get our way out of this?
Well, I mean, I suppose it is in theory impossible, but in practice, everybody in the room will know that in the end, either some kind of a deal is done on everything, or it isn't, and there's some very difficult break. But 20, 30, 40 years from now, it will, you know, Britain and the European Union 27, if it could be a number bigger or smaller than that, will still be there, and they will have a relationship, and it'll all settle down, and everybody who was involved in this will have gone away, and that'll just be the new world as we then know it. And I mean, as far as I can see, it is this, that for the people who are strongly favouring the UK leaving the EU with the greatest and most obvious break, they're the ones who I think probably risk most disappointment moving forward, because the sum total of what business in particular argues for, and many members of the political establishment, if you believe that political establishments are powerful, you'd have to believe they've got a chance of getting what they want on this, as some people believe they do on everything. If that is the case, then, you know, what we will see is much effort made to getting Britain, I personally think Britain will leave the European Union, but then trying to get back towards all the terms and conditions as they operate today, but renegotiated in a, to use the cliche of the moment, bespoke way. So we will be outside the currency union, but with an agreement that means we are so near to being inside the customs union, sorry, currency, it's a big mistake, customs union for the avoidance of doubt, back into the customs union without actually being in it. Again, the event that Kevin Featherstone and I were at earlier, the question of, you know, the European Court of Justice, and the, you know, how far will disagreements between the UK and the EU 27 be adjudicated? Well, you know, could we move out of the oversight of that court and then have something else which is very like it but not it? And you know, and so, and the nearer we get towards that world, which I suspect is what Remainers want, the more sad I suspect the pro-leave people will be. And that looks to me like the more likely direction of change, but who knows? You know, I might end up with a radical break, big effect on the UK and the EU, and some kind of baleful trade war and you know, resetting the entire UK economic model to be a sort of Singapore on Thames, as has been threatened. Nothing wrong with Singapore or the Thames, for the avoidance of doubt. Both wonderful things, places. But I agree with you, it's going to be long and difficult, and the role of the media in responding to everything as it happens will also affect all of this. And somebody, again, there's a very, you see, I'm sorry to keep referring to an event most people in the room weren't present at, but the other point that I heard made, which I'll dwell upon this morning, is that the British side of the negotiations, if you just forget everybody else for a minute, the British side and the EU27 side, the British side of the negotiation will take place profoundly influenced by public opinion and the media. Whereas the EU27 side is much less influenced by public opinion and the media, because it's less important to any of those countries individually, and therefore their media collectively. Whereas for us, this is a dominant political issue. For most countries in the EU27, it's less important today than, you know, Greece's current problems within the Eurozone. So I take your point. I'm just saying in a long-winded way I agree with you, but I suspect that in the end we will all survive. That's the best I can do by, you know, we'll get over this. Now, there was a question there, then here. Yep, chap there. Can you stand up just for the cameras? I'm sorry about this.
Hi, I'm Ruben, master student at LSE. Having seen this long list of challenges and open questions, why are you so certain that the UK will leave the EU? Thank you.
Well, because of the dominance in British political discourse of the concept that one vote is enough. So, Parliament empowered a referendum. The people voted by, admittedly, not a million-type number of people, but by a margin to leave the EU. And I think members of Parliament, who are at the best of times, and again, nothing to do with Brexit, quite wary of the public. They have, you know, politicians are not held in particularly high esteem, and they're always trying, MPs as a group and political parties, to ingratiate themselves as far as they can with the public. The idea of running against the public when not only a majority voted to leave the EU, but there's no evidence at all that that number is shrinking. And indeed, there's been some polling that shows that even people who voted to, I think I've got this right, even people who voted to remain think that on balance, fair's fair means we should leave. So, you know, you can even be a Remainer who believes that we should leave because that's the way the vote went, just on a sort of what's fair principle. So I think that it would be, I mean, the only qualification, and it's a great question, don't get me wrong, would be if something unexpected happened, you know, Harold Macmillan's famous events, one of them happened, which somehow changed all the economics and political geography, all of this that none of us can think of. And more of those things happen from time to time these days than used to. When everybody, so if suddenly public opinion changed and Parliament felt empowered to change, and to have a second referendum or not to leave, you know, nothing's impossible. I'm just saying, on the balance of the settled world that we're in, I think it's more likely that we'll leave than not. But nothing is impossible. You know, we now know nothing is impossible. Chap here, lady there. Him first, sorry. Sorry, too many. One, two, three.
Hi, Andrew Summers from the Law Department. Question about the Great Repeal Bill in relation to parliamentary sovereignty. I mean, obviously, first kind of trite point to make is that the Great Repeal Bill would have been better called the Great Copy and Paste Bill, in the sense that what it immediately does is, far from repealing all this legislation, it actually retains all of the EU law in UK law until it's finally removed. But then the devil's in the detail as to how it's removed, and that's where I think the big concern potentially with parliamentary sovereignty arises, because as I understand it, I think in practice these the process of repealing these individual elements of what was EU law is going to be heavily reliant on these Henry VIII powers. And as I understand from the white paper, I think it only suggests that immigration and trade policy are things that must be dealt with in the future using a further act of parliament. So by implication, all of these other areas that are currently part of EU law that are going to be transposed into UK law, such as workers' rights, environmental protections, and so on and so forth, are all ripe for repeal just effectively by government action with minimal parliamentary scrutiny. And that seems to be potentially a much bigger threat to parliamentary sovereignty than what we've been debating recently. But it has a slightly different dimension, which is that, I mean, well, this is my question for you. I mean, you mentioned very interestingly that the Article 50 debate may have strengthened the government's hand, even though its aim was to increase parliamentary sovereignty. It seems unlikely that that dynamic will occur in relation to these Henry VIII powers. There, I think you're much more likely to see a real tension between parliamentary sovereignty and, yeah, the effect of this great repeal bill. But I just wondered how you thought that would play out.
Well, I think you've elegantly taken what I said and gone rather further than I managed, if I may say so. And there's a lifetime's work for students and colleagues in the law department to look at this, so thank goodness you're here. I take the point that Parliament is unlikely to go along with much Henry VIII. I mean, they don't like it, and they're right not to like it. It is the use of powers that are... I mean, the very use of the term Henry VIII kind of begins to send a signal, doesn't it? So I think that Parliament, and especially when sectional or local or other interests are visibly affected, Parliament's bound to want to make a stand. And it's just not going to be pushed out of the way. So I take your point precisely. On one of these issues, though, I mean, when it comes to things like workers' rights and so on, where I think that the sense that leaving the EU, and there were certainly a number of pro-leave politicians and others who sort of thought this would lead to a massive clearing out of all this European red tape. Truth is, I think there's a lot of evidence that people in Britain love all that red tape. They do not want to... They may not like red tape, but they like the protections that it affords. And so the idea that a UK government's got much latitude here to sweep out of the way workers' rights, other protections, health and safety rules, environmental rules, and so on, I think is unlikely, because most British parliamentarians are deep down, well, not that deep down, centrist, European, social, Christian, Democrat types, and they believe in all this stuff. So the idea that we would somehow leave the EU and immediately industries would be allowed to, you know, create smokestacks and pollute. I just think it's for the birds. I think it's, you know, personally, we in the UK have a view about standards of business and transparency and public life, which are towards, you know, the international indices show Britain is quite high up, the transparency index, for example. So I just don't think, you know, so I think that although if there were some radical change, and I take your point about the great cut and paste bill, that's very good. Consolidation is the politer word I'd heard use, but I can see where you're going. And with that in mind, I suspect that a lot of it will just be embedded there. And in 500 years' time, scholars in the law department of the LSE will be, as they now look at the Magna Carta, looking at the body of British law, English law, and then saying, oh, this is one that came from Europe. You know, they'll be studying some ancient text about this is one that came from Europe. It's still there 500 years from now. So I hope you're still there to study it. Great question. Right now, lady here. I'm sorry, there. Kevin can wait till last. He can talk to me all the time. Go on.
Krishna Popovsky, UCL. I would like, I feel that the EU, the deal, which is going to be struck with the EU, is going to have a constitutional consequences for the UK, is going to have also consequences when it comes to the social structure of the UK and also spatial structure of the UK. We are going to see, in my opinion, much bigger, I don't know what you think, and I'm interested in that, in the rural and urban divide, and also we are going to see in a social structure divide between people who are going to be able to make it and not make it in the UK. But that is a broader picture. What I'm actually interested in is a couple of points which you raised. One is connected with the previous question. You quoted from the white paper that EU laws are going to be converted into British laws wherever practical. And I think that's very clever from the the way they put it in, because everything what you talked about is, and the lawyers are saying that, at least the one I talked to, that they are going to incorporate as much EU laws as possible under British law so that negotiations are possible and the deal is possible. But what interests me is at the very beginning you were saying that the issue of migration, that in last 3 to 4 years there is quite a lot of migrants coming into the EU, as we know, and that it's not the fault of the EU. I don't think it's a good thing sometimes to talk in the terms of being anybody's fault. But I think especially the UK played an important role in the number of migrants which we have, not in this country, but in the countries where I come from, the former Yugoslavia. We now know that in Serbia and in Belgrade there is a huge number of migrants gathering, and they cannot go any further. So I think in a way this deal is maybe not so interesting, such a big interest to 27 countries, but to some countries in the EU it has big implication. And one thing which I feel in a way sudden, that during the EU referendum we never heard what are the consequences for Europe, EU, when Britain is going to leave. The British politicians exclusively talked about the UK.
Okay, well, look, very briefly, because I know we've got to be out, physically, geographically out by 1:29. I take your point entirely that the UK, in an earlier manifestation of its government, actually, as it were, encouraged other countries to join the EU and willingly accepted no constraints on migration from day one. That's a matter of fact and history. But I think as far as the rest of Europe is concerned, I think inside the LSE, I'm sure we can say there'll be a lot of thought given and events taking place on that. But more generally, and I doubt this is, it's hard to judge this from inside a country, I'm not an expert on overseas at all on other countries, but I mean, countries looking at their own history, particularly when they're islands with long histories, with particular versions to them, as all countries have their own versions of history. I'm not that surprised that people in Britain are not that interested in the detail of how all of this affects the rest of Europe. Personally, and Theresa May, to her credit, has made this point. She wants the EU to continue to be successful, and I think she's right to do that. So we have a vested interest in Europe being peaceful and economically successful, and let's just hope that idea gets transmitted strongly, in the weeks and months ahead. And in fairness, many of the pro-leave campaigners didn't have an animus against European countries and Europe as such. It was against the European Union as an institution, but I agree the risk of conflating them, as happens with the European Court of Human Rights and the Council of Europe, which I should have mentioned, the conflation is a real problem. There was one more point, though. We must be quick. I'm sorry. If you can stand up, that would be good for the cameras.
Lorenzo Codogno, European Institute. It's a very simple question, although the answer might not be as simple as the question. But anyway, you mentioned that the big deal might be many years into the future, and correctly so. Everybody expects, 2 years not to be enough to do the big job. But there is another deal that, at least if we believe what Barnier is saying, there is a so-called separation bill, which is a much smaller endeavor, so to speak, but still quite not easy, okay? And what is the kind of time frame that you would expect for this deal to take place?
Well, beyond the 2 years of the Article 50 process. I mean, aiming off for the fact that some people say 15 years and others say it can all be done quickly, let's say about 7.5 years, let's know. I mean, that's a slightly trite... Given what we know about, and I don't know, it's not my world really, about the length of time it takes to, particularly to sign deals between blocks, and the EU itself is a complicated block, with individual regions within Belgium being able to have a say in deals, then, I think that, oddly, the UK will be able to make deals faster than the EU, probably. I mean, just because the EU government will... A, need to do that to show it all works, and B, it's just one point of decision-making. So bilateral deals between the UK and the US or the UK and China, I suspect, will be probably quicker than those that involve the UK with a bloc. And therefore, how long the final deal with, say, the EU27... Yeah, I doubt it's going to be done in 5 years. Perhaps not 20, perhaps not 10, somewhere out there. But we'll see. And it all depends on goodwill, doesn't it? If people of goodwill do this, it can be done in 3 years.
How about the separation?
The separation? You mean the cost?
The pensions of the commission personnel?
Well, I'm lucky enough to have become an expert on this earlier this morning. At the earlier event. But, it's going to start off with one side pitching a large number, the other side saying naught, and then the question is, how far the haggling over that number has to be gone through in order to start the process of exiting before the process of renegotiation starts. And one would hope, I put it no higher than that, that diplomats... we need diplomats, are already at this kind of thing to try to get a narrow space for a rational deal. Anyway, we need to stop there. It's 1:29:30. Thank you all for coming. And we start next week. There is a week off. But if I go back to the programme, on the 22nd, we hear on the economic impact of Brexit from a panel. So please come back then. Thank you all.